Chapter 6. Simple. Jocko Willink. Combat Outpost Falcon. Ramadi, Iraq. Into the fray. A massive explosion shook the walls of the building I was sitting in, right in the middle of Combat Outpost, or COP, Falcon. Adrenaline shot from my core, down my arms, and into my hands. Seconds later, another explosion rocked the compound. Soon the word spread. Mortars. Insurgents had lobbed 120mm mortar rounds smack dab into the center of COP Falcon with deadly accuracy. 120s were vicious. Each massive projectile carried 20-plus pounds of high explosives, wrapped in a half-inch thick steel jacket, designed to throw jagged pieces of shrapnel in all directions, causing catastrophic wounds and death. The rounds had wounded several American soldiers at COP Falcon, one critically, who later succumbed to his injuries. A third 120mm mortar round hit the roof of the building I was in, but thankfully, for the soldiers nearby, it didn't explode. It was a dud. The mortars were alarmingly accurate, proving once again that the insurgents we were fighting were highly capable. As daylight dawned on this early morning, it was a grim reminder that this was dangerous territory, and we were sitting right in the middle of it. The night before, Leif and his SEALs from Task Unit Bruiser's Charlie Platoon had inserted from U.S. Marine Corps small unit riverine craft CIRC boats, manned by a great crew of highly motivated Marines. Charlie Platoon SEALs, accompanied by an expert team from the 2nd U.S. Marine Air Naval Gunfire Liaison Company, Anglico, with which they often worked closely, a small Army sniper team, and a partner force of Iraqi soldiers had hopped from the CIRC boats onto the riverbank. They quietly sneaked into this enemy-controlled neighborhood, one of the most violent areas of Ramadi. Our SEALs were the first U.S. boots on the ground. They led the opening salvo of this massive operation, involving hundreds of U.S. soldiers, tanks, and aircraft to establish a combat outpost, literally in the center of enemy-controlled territory. Within minutes of their arrival, Charlie Platoon had killed an armed insurgent fighter patrolling the neighborhood in the early morning darkness. SEALs then seized and cleared the building complex that was to become COP Falcon and held it for a few hours into the night, while SEAL snipers provided cover for the dozens of U.S. Army tanks and vehicles that followed the IED clearance teams along the road into the area. I had ridden in with the U.S. Army Battalion Task Force 137 Bandits, 1st Battalion, 37th Armored Regiment, 1st Armored Division, in an M2 Bradley fighting vehicle early in the morning before the sun had risen to link up with Leif and Charlie Platoon. My job was command and control of our SEALs. I would coordinate their efforts with Task Force Bandits soldiers. Shortly after our arrival, Charlie Platoon's SEALs turned the buildings they had cleared and occupied over to the U.S. Army Company Commander of Team Bulldog and other soldiers of Task Force 137 Bandit. Then, Leif and most of the SEALs pushed out to a building a few hundred yards down the road to set up another sniper position. I remained at COP Falcon to coordinate their movements, providing overwatch for the Army engineers as they built COP Falcon into a defensible position. This required extensive planning, coordination, and hours of intense labor to haul and emplace some 30,000 sandbags, over 150 concrete barriers, and hundreds of yards of concertina wire. It had been a long night. The jarring impact of the deadly mortars was our morning wake-up call. There had been intermittent small arms fire throughout the night, but no serious firefights. The mortars were the first real attack that did damage and inflicted casualties. Not that it slowed down the operation. The courageous Army engineers had a job to do, and they kept working, swinging hammers and operating heavy machinery, even as the bullets flew. They were brave soldiers, to a man. As the hot Iraqi sun rose above the dusty city streets and people awakened, so did the bulk of the enemy fighters. I soon heard the loud report of SEAL sniper rifles from Charlie Platoon's position on the high ground in a four-story apartment building a few hundred meters down the street. Leif relayed to me via radio that his SEAL snipers had engaged enemy fighters maneuvering to attack Cop Falcon. But building the combat outpost in enemy territory was only the beginning. There was more to be done. One of the primary objectives in placing this combat outpost in the heart of enemy territory was to show the local populace that we, the coalition of American and Iraqi soldiers, were here to stay, and that we did not fear the Al-Qaeda insurgents who had controlled most of Ramadi unchecked for years. This could not be accomplished by sitting and hiding inside heavily reinforced bases. The troops had to go out and into the neighborhood surrounding the COP. They had to conduct a type of operation so straightforward its name requires almost no explanation: a presence patrol. It required a group of soldiers to push into enemy-held areas to establish their presence among the populace. In this situation, the mission called for a combined operation, including Iraqi and American soldiers working together. A U.S. Army officer from a military transition team, teams of U.S. soldiers or Marines, built and deployed to train and combat advise Iraqi soldiers, known as MITs, planned to lead a group of Iraqi soldiers out into the neighborhood. The MIT leader was very excited to get out on patrol with his Iraqi soldiers and test their mettle. He had been working and training with them for several months in another city in northern Iraq and had conducted some fairly benign patrols and combat operations with them. But this was Ramadi. There would be nothing easy or benign about patrolling into these neighborhoods. Here, the enemy was determined, well-armed, and ready. They would be waiting to attack and kill any U.S. soldier, SEAL, Marine, or Iraqi soldier that they could. My immediate discussions with the MIT leader revealed he did not fully appreciate the dangers that lay in store. I was also concerned that his Iraqi soldiers might not yet be ready for the intense street fighting that was likely to take place in this sector of Ramadi. So I assigned a small group of our SEALs to accompany him and his Iraqi soldiers as command and control to help coordinate any help should they need it. I stood with one of Charlie Platoon's young SEAL officers, who would lead the SEAL element accompanying the Iraqi soldiers, as the MIT leader strolled over to us and pulled out his battle map to brief us on the route he intended for the patrol. He outlined a path that snaked through the treacherous city streets and stretched clear across south central Ramadi over to the next U.S. combat outpost to the east, Cop Eagle's Nest. This was nearly 2 kilometers through some of the most hostile territory in Iraq, held by a determined and vicious enemy. None of the roads had been cleared by the U.S. minesweeping teams, so no doubt massive IEDs laid buried along the route. That meant U.S. armored vehicles and firepower could not get to the patrol along much of the leader's planned path without putting the vehicles at huge risk, should he and his Iraqis, and now our SEALs, get pinned down. Beyond that, his planned route passed through battle space owned by different American units, including 2 U.S. Army companies, another Army battalion, and a U.S. Marine Corps company. Each had unique standard operating procedures and utilized separate radio nets. That would mean coordinating with all these units prior to launch and setting up contingency plans for help should something go wrong. The amount of water needed for such a long trek in the Iraqi summertime heat that exceeded 115 degrees Fahrenheit, along with the massive amount of ammunition required to penetrate so deeply into enemy territory, added up to far more than anyone could effectively fight with or carry. Even in a much more permissive or peaceful environment, the MIT leader's plan for patrol across battle space owned by different units would be extremely complex. To try to accomplish this, in the worst neighborhoods of Ramadi, the most hazardous battlefield in Iraq, was just plain crazy. I listened to the plan. When I understood the overall idea and the complexity it involved, I finally commented, "Lieutenant, I appreciate your motivation to get out there and get after it. But perhaps, at least for these first few patrols, we need to simplify this a little bit. Simplify? Asked the MIT leader incredulously. It's just a patrol. How complex can it get? I nodded my head respectfully. I know it's just a patrol, I said, but there are some risks that can compound when working in an environment like this. It's nothing I haven't trained these Iraqis on, he responded confidently. While I appreciated his confidence, I knew it was hard for the lieutenant to fully grasp the complexities of the mission he was planning when he had not executed missions in such a hostile environment. I know you have trained them well, and I'm sure your Iraqi soldiers are a good group, I said, knowing it was likely they had never been in a serious firefight together. But let's look at what you have here. This route will take you through 3 separate battle space owners, 2 Army and 1 Marine Corps. It will take you into areas that are known to be heavily IED'd, which will make any type of support, like casualty evacuation or fire support from tanks, extremely risky. They may not even be able to get to you at all. Even though you've worked extensively with all these Iraqi soldiers, my SEALs haven't worked with them at all. So do you think, at least for this first patrol, we can simplify this a little by cutting down the distance and keeping the entire patrol inside battle space owned by this company, Team Bulldog? That will only be a few hundred meters out, the MIT leader objected. I know, I replied. I know it seems short, but let's just keep it simple to start, and we can expand as we get more experience. I knew that one real operation in this environment for the MIT leader would convince him that simplicity was key. After some further discussion, the MIT leader agreed to do a much shorter, simpler route. Soon after, the MIT leader, his Iraqi soldiers, and a small contingent of SEALs gathered around to go through an OPORD, which is the operations order, the pre-mission brief that explains the details of the operation to the members of the team. It was this Iraqi element's first patrol in Ramadi, and despite the mortars that had hit and wounded several U.S. soldiers, and the constant sound of gunfire in the background, they didn't seem too concerned. Neither did the MIT leader. Neither, for that matter, did my SEAL element leader. Everyone seemed pretty nonchalant about the patrol. I knew that contact with the enemy was highly likely, if not imminent. After the brief, they split up to do some final preparations, grab water, check ammo and weapons, and go over individual instructions. I went in and covered the route again with the SEAL element leader, noting landmarks such as easily recognizable buildings, unique intersections, water towers, and mosque minarets, which could be used as reference points. We also looked at the battle map, with an overlay of numbers assigned to every building in this sector of the city. The young SEAL officer and I reviewed the building numbers of prominent buildings in the area so we could better communicate both the patrol's position and the position of the enemy, should we need to do so. The combined element then mustered to form up and begin the patrol. I had already coordinated with Leif to have his element of SEALs in their sniper overwatch position in the 4-story building 300 meters outside the perimeter of Kop Valken cover the movement of the presence patrol. With precision sniper fire, machine guns, rockets, and an elevated fighting position, Leif's element could effectively protect the movement of the patrol through the streets. That would help mitigate the risk of enemy attack. I watched closely the attitude of the troops getting ready to head out. It wasn't real for them yet. Finally, I walked up to the young SEAL leader, looked him in the eye, and said, "You are going to get contacted out there. It will happen quick. Stay sharp. Understand?" My serious tone impacted the young SEAL lieutenant, who nodded slowly and confirmed, "Got it, sir. Will do." With that, I stepped back and watched the patrol head out the gate of Kop Valken and into enemy territory. Curious as to how long it might take for enemy fighters to attack, I pressed start on my stopwatch as the patrol stepped off. This was the first overt presence patrol into this section of South Central Ramadi by coalition soldiers in months, perhaps years. Task Unit Bruiser's Delta Platoon, working in an adjacent sector across the city, had for the past 2 months been attacked by enemy fighters on almost every single patrol. I monitored the radio at Kop Valken tracking the patrol's progress. Suddenly, gunfire rang out, echoing across the city blocks. An enemy AK-47 in the near distance. A SEAL machine gunner answered. It was immediately joined by dozens of other weapons that let loose a hellacious barrage of fire, which confirmed to me that these were my SEALs in contact. There was no other unit that unleashed such fury when the shooting started. I looked at my watch. It had been 12 minutes since the patrol stepped off from Cop Falcon. From my position at the cop, I listened to the radio calls. They were broken and jumbled, weakened by the thick concrete walls of city buildings that radio waves could not always penetrate. The shooting continued. It was a substantial firefight. Volleys of gunfire rattled back and forth between the patrol and enemy fighters. More garbled communications. I recognized the voice of the SEAL element leader with the patrol, but couldn't make out what he was saying. Leif, on the high ground with direct line of sight to both of us, had good radio communications both with the SEAL leader on the ground with the patrol and with me. Leif received a situational update from the patrol. He and the young SEAL element leader both communicated with a clear, calm voice, despite the chaos of the situation, just like we had trained. Leif relayed the report to me. Two friendlies wounded. Need Kazovac and fire support. In order to quickly get tanks and Kazovac vehicles out to help the patrol, I needed to get direct radio communications with the SEAL officer in the patrol and confirm their position. I quickly sprinted to the top of the largest building on Cop Falcon, stood up, and extended my radio antenna for maximum reception. I keyed up my radio and tried to reach the patrol. Red Bull, this is Jocko. Go, Jocko, responded the SEAL leader with the patrol in a calm voice. We now had direct radio communications. What do you got? I asked. Two wounded. Need Kazovac and fire support, he responded. Just as he had been taught. Simple, clear, concise information. Exactly what was needed. Roger. Confirm your location, I said. Building Juliet 5-1, he replied. Are all your troops in Juliet 5-1? I asked. Affirm, all friendly troops in Juliet 5-1, he confirmed. Roger. Tanks and Kazovac inbound, I notified him. I sprinted back down to the first floor into the makeshift talk where Team Bulldog's company commander stood waiting for the information he needed to get his troops and tanks moving out. What's going on out there, sir? The company commander asked. What do they need? Calmly, I relayed to him the critical info. They need fire support and Kazovac in vicinity of building Juliet 5-1. All friendly personnel are consolidated inside building Juliet 5-1. There are two wounded. I stepped to the huge battle map hanging on the wall next to us and guided my finger to building Juliet 5-1 on the map. Right here, I said and pointed to ensure everybody was clear. Got it, sir, answered the company commander. I'll take a section of tanks and an M113 to building Juliet 5-1. All friendlies are located in that building. Two wounded. Check, I replied, confirming he had all the information correct. He quickly flew out the door toward his tank, briefed his troops, and personally mounted up. He and his men would brave the dangerous IED-laden streets to get the SEALs, American MIT advisors, and Iraqi troops pinned down under enemy attack. They would do their utmost to save the lives of their wounded. Meanwhile, from the vantage point of Leif's overwatch position, his SEAL snipers and machine gunners engaged numerous enemy fighters as they rallied to join the attack on the patrol. The powerful sniper rifles our SEALs used made a distinct crack as they engaged multiple enemy fighters sneaking toward the friendly patrol hunkered down in building Juliet 5-1. As insurgent fighters rallied to attack the patrol, SEAL machine gunners from the overwatch position joined in and laid down a barrage of fire, beating back the enemy assault. Within minutes, Team Bulldog's tanks and M113 arrived at building Juliet 5-1. At the sight of the tanks, most of the enemy fighters disappeared into the urban landscape, hiding their weapons to blend in among the civilian populace. The two casualties were Iraqi soldiers. Both had been shot. One, while crossing the street, had been abandoned by his fellow Iraqi soldiers who fled to cover. Luckily for him, two SEALs risked their lives to run out into the street through a hail of enemy gunfire and drag him to safety. Both casualties were evacuated. One Iraqi soldier survived. The other, unfortunately, died from his wounds. Under the cover of the tank's firepower, the rest of the patrol exited building Juliet 5-1 and fell into a column formation, bracketed by the two Abrams tanks, one fore and one aft, like a scene from World War II. Together, they moved back toward Cop Falcon. As Team Bulldog's tank covered the rear, an insurgent fighter with an RPG-7 rocket rounded the corner to take a shot at the patrol. But before he could fire the rocket, Team Bulldog's company commander, sitting in the turret of his tank, plugged him in the chest with a .50 caliber machine gun. When the patrol made it back to Cop Falcon, I met them as they entered the compound. Making eye contact with the young SEAL leader in the patrol, I gave him an approving nod that, without words, said, "Well done. You kept your composure and you made clear calls. You got the help you needed and kept the rest of your team alive." The SEAL leader nodded back. He understood. The MIT leader was clearly shaken up. It had been his first serious firefight, his first real test as a leader. Luckily, he had our SEAL element with him, which helped ensure his patrol's survival. Fortunately, he'd agreed to keep his mission simple, to minimize complexity for the inevitable contingencies that could arise. It was a worst-case scenario. Had this gunfight happened where he'd originally planned to go, much deeper into enemy territory, out of the range of Cop Falcon, with separate, supporting Army or Marine elements that had different radio frequencies and different operating procedures, it would likely have been catastrophic. If they had made this patrol more difficult and complex than it already was, the MIT leader and all his Iraqi soldiers might have been killed. I gave the MIT leader a different nod than the one I gave the SEAL leader. This nod said, "That's why we keep it simple." The MIT leader looked back at me. He didn't say a word, but his eyes communicated to me clearly. "I know that now. I understand." Principle. Combat, like anything in life, has inherent layers of complexities. Simplifying as much as possible is crucial to success. When plans and orders are too complicated, people may not understand them. And when things go wrong, and they inevitably do go wrong, complexity compounds issues that can spiral out of control into total disaster. Plans and orders must be communicated in a manner that is simple, clear, and concise. Everyone that is part of the mission must know and understand his or her role in the mission and what to do in the event of likely contingencies. As a leader, it doesn't matter how well you feel you have presented the information or communicated in an order, plan, tactic, or strategy. If your team doesn't get it, you have not kept things simple and you have failed. You must brief to ensure the lowest common denominator on the team understands. It is critical, as well, that the operating relationship facilitate the ability of the frontline troops to ask questions that clarify when they do not understand the mission or key tasks to be performed. Leaders must encourage this communication and take the time to explain so that every member of the team understands. Simple. This principle isn't limited to the battlefield. In the business world and in life, there are inherent complexities. It is critical to keep plans and communication simple. Following this rule is crucial to the success of any team in combat, business, or life. Application to business. "I don't have any idea what this means," the employee said, as he held up a piece of paper that was supposed to explain his monthly bonus. "0.84, he continued. "I have no idea what that number means. What I do know is that my bonus for this month was $423.97, but I have no idea why. Last month I made $279. Don't know why. I did the same amount of work, produced about the same amount of units, but for some reason, I got shortchanged last month. What the hell? Are they trying to get you to focus on one aspect of your job? I inquired. Honestly, I have no idea, he replied. I mean, I'm happy for the bonus, but I don't know what they want me to focus on. I spoke to several other assembly technicians in this division on a visit to the manufacturing plant of a client company. Over and over, I heard similar answers. People weren't sure what they should be focused on. They had no idea how their bonuses were calculated or why they were being rewarded or penalized in pay each month. The next day, I met with the chief engineer and plant manager. They were both extremely smart and passionate about the company and took a lot of pride in their products. They also recognized there was a disconnect. We definitely are not maximizing our efficiency with our production staff, said the plant manager, her frustration evident. No doubt about it, explained the chief engineer. We have a relatively small line of products here. There are some nuances, but they are all similar to produce. We thought we could ramp up production when we created the bonus plan, but it hasn't really worked. Yeah, added the plant manager. There is a real opportunity to make significant money through the bonus plan, but the employees on the line don't seem to adapt and focus to take advantage of it. Explain to me how the bonus system works, I said. Okay, it's a little tricky, warned the plant manager. That's fine. I'm sure it can't be too hard, I replied, knowing that excessive complexity was one of the major problems of any SEAL unit or any military unit on the battlefield. It was essential to keep things simple so that everyone on the team understood. Honestly, it's pretty complex, the plant manager answered, as there are a lot of different aspects that we need to work on to ensure that different facets of production were accounted for. Well, maybe you could just give me the basics then, I requested. The plant manager began. Okay, so it starts off with a base level of productivity. Now, as you know, we have 6 different units that we assemble here, each with varying levels of complexity. So what we did was give them a weight. Our most commonly produced model sets the standard with a weight of 1.0. Our most complex model is weighted 1.75, and the simplest model is a 0.5, with the other models weighted somewhere in between based on the level of difficulty in assembly. Of course, those are what we call base weights, added the chief engineer. Depending on the orders we get for various models, sometimes we need to increase production of a certain model, so we have a variable weight curve, which means the weight can be adjusted up or down depending on the specific demand at any time. And this is where we had to get crafty. When we take the total weighted number of units produced, and we have a tiered efficiency metric, the plant manager said, clearly proud of the complex system they had developed. She explained in intricate detail how the variable tiered system worked, stratified based on the number of people that had made bonus in each tier every month. That way, a certain level of competitiveness is inspired, and we prevent ourselves from paying out too many bonuses, which we feel would decrease their impact, concluded the plant manager. But it didn't end there. She went into greater detail on how the efficiency metric was then compared to the employee's previous 6-month tiered breakout and how an employee who maintained the top 25% stratification could receive an additional percentage on their bonus. On top of that, they factored in the quality of the product. The chief engineer and the plant manager outlined a list of common faults, breaking these out as either hold faults, which could be corrected, or fatal faults, which rendered a unit unusable. For each fault and type of fault registered, a graduated weight system multiplied by a certain factor reduced an employee's potential bonus. A similar multiple added to the bonus for employees who had no registered faults in the units they produced. While the senior management expressed pride in the bonus system they had created, it was staggeringly complex. I was quiet for a few moments. Then I asked, "That's it?" "Well," answered the plant manager, "there are several other little nuanced factors that we do calculate for." "Really?" I questioned, surprised that they didn't catch my sarcasm. "I'm kidding. Well, that's crazy." "Crazy? What's crazy?" she asked defensively. They were so close to the bonus plan, so emotional and passionate about it, that they didn't recognize the vast complexity of it. They didn't see their own fatal fault in the confusing and elaborate scheme they had created, one that no one in the team understood. "That is an extremely complex plan, too complex. I think you really need to simplify, I said. Well, it is a complex environment. Perhaps if we drew it out for you, you would understand, the chief engineer responded. It doesn't matter if I understand, I responded. What matters is that they understand it, your production team. And not in some theoretical way. They need to understand it to a point that they don't need to be thinking about it to understand it. It needs to be on the top of their minds all the time. But we have to make sure we incentivize them in the right direction, said the chief engineer. Exactly, echoed the plant manager. We've got to take the variables into account so they are constantly pushed or pulled the right way. They had each very clearly put extensive time and effort into the bonus plan, and now tried to desperately defend their efforts despite its glaring, overly complex deficiency. How well is this bonus plan working to incentivize them now? I asked. You just told me they aren't taking advantage of it, so they aren't being effectively incentivized to do anything differently, or to move in any direction. Your plan is so complex that there is no way that they can mindfully move in the direction that would increase their bonus. Even when they use operant conditioning on rats, the rats have to understand what they are being punished or rewarded for. If there's not a strong enough correlation between the behavior and the reward or the punishment, then the behavior will never be modified. If the rats don't know why they received a sugar pellet or why they were just giving an electric shock, they will not change. So our people are rats? The chief engineer said jokingly. I laughed. It was funny. But then I replied, no, not at all, but all animals, including humans, need to see the connection between action and consequence in order to learn to react appropriately. The way you have this set up, they can't see that connection. Well, they could see it if they looked and took the time to figure it out, replied the production manager. It certainly is possible that they could, but they don't. People generally take the path of least resistance. It is just in our nature. Let me ask you this. What kind of quantifiable lift have you gotten out of this incentive plan? I asked. You know, honestly, we haven't seen any real meaningful pickup, the production manager admitted. Definitely not as much as we thought we would. This actually isn't surprising to me, I said. Your plan violates one of the most important principles we adhered to in combat, simplicity. When young SEAL leaders in training look at targets for training missions, they often try to develop a course of action that accounts for every single possibility they can think of. That results in a plan that is extraordinarily complex and very difficult to follow. While the troops might understand their individual pieces of a plan, they have a hard time following all the intricacies of the grand scheme. Perhaps they can even get away with that a few times if everything goes smoothly. But remember, the enemy gets a vote. The enemy gets a vote, the plant manager repeated, questioning what that meant. Yes, regardless of how you think an operation is going to unfold, I answered, the enemy gets their say as well, and they are going to do something to disrupt it. When something goes wrong, and it eventually does, complex plans add to confusion, which can compound into disaster. Almost no mission ever goes according to plan. There are simply too many variables to deal with. This is where simplicity is key. If the plan is simple enough, everyone understands it, which means each person can rapidly adjust and modify what he or she is doing. If the plan is too complex, the team can't make rapid adjustments to it because there's no baseline understanding of it. That makes sense, the chief engineer said. We followed that rule with everything we did, I continued. Our standard operating procedures were always kept as simple as possible. Our communication plans were simple. The way we talked on the radio was as simple and direct as possible. The way we organized our gear, even the way we got a headcount to ensure we had all of our people, was broken down into the simplest possible method so we could do it quickly, accurately, and easily at any time. With all this simplicity embedded in the way we worked, our troops clearly understood what they were doing and how that tied into the mission. That core understanding allowed us to adapt quickly without stumbling over ourselves. I can see how that would be a huge advantage, said the plant manager. Okay then, I concluded. We have nothing to lose. The best way to make your bonus plan work is to go back to the drawing board and figure out a new model for compensation, with 2 or 3, no more than 4, areas to measure and grade upon. The chief engineer and the plant manager accepted the mission I laid out for them and headed back to their office to get to work. The next day, I walked into the office. They had their plan written up on their dry erase board. It had only two parts. One, weighted units. Two, quality. "That's it?" I inquired, this time without sarcasm. "That's it," the plant manager replied. "Very simple. You produce as many units as you can. We will still adjust the weights of the units based on demand, but we will set the weights on Monday and let them stay there until Friday. That still gives us time the next week to make adjustments and change weights if demand spikes on a certain unit. And we are going to post the weights of each unit out there on the bulletin board so that every employee on the line sees it, knows it, and is thinking about it. The quality piece we will measure each month. Anyone with a quality score of 95% or higher will receive a 15% increase in their bonus." "I like it," I replied. This plan was much easier to communicate and much easier to understand. When you need to adjust it, you will be able to do so with ease. That afternoon, I watched as the chief engineer and plant manager discussed the plan with the team leads and the afternoon shift. The response was great. The employees now had a good understanding of what it was they needed to do to earn their bonus. As a result, the bonus now truly incentivized behavior and could thereby make the company more productive. In the coming weeks, the plant manager and chief engineer reported an almost immediate increase in productivity. More employees focused their energy on what product would make them more money, which was, of course, aligned with the goals of the company. There were secondary effects as well. As the higher producing employees strove harder to increase their bonuses, the lower producing workers were left with less orders to fulfill. Within a month, the company let go the four employees with the lowest bonus scores, who had long been the weakest performers and had dragged down the entire team. Now, the company no longer needed them, as the rest of the crew had drastically increased their efficiency. The most impressive thing about this improvement in performance was that it did not come from a major process change or an advance in technology. Instead, it came through a leadership principle that has been around for ages. Simple.